Chapter 3. The next morning, flat, calm. Edith awoke to a mild pinkish dusk. Levering herself up cautiously in the unfamiliar bed, she peered at her watch to try to see the time. She had supposed it to be very early. She remembered waking some time before and hearing a door close quietly some little way down the corridor. But she saw to her surprise that it was nearly 8 o'clock, and a finger of light appearing through the veal-coloured curtains seemed to contain the promise of a fine day. She rang for breakfast and then got up and pulled the curtains. In her long white nightgown, she stepped out onto the little balcony and shivered in the cold air. But the mist was lifting from the lake, and ahead of her, in the far distance, she could see a dark grey shape, which, as she looked, gained in both outline and volume, the mountain. Below her, a small boat puttered quietly at the landing stage, and the chef appeared in his sponge bag trousers, his white jacket, to take the day's delivery of fresh perch. The impassive boy who had stood behind the chair of the woman with the dog delivered her breakfast tray, sliding it down from shoulder height onto her little table. "Merci," she said, her voice still unfamiliar to her, for it had not been used for some time. "Il fait froid." "Il a neigé cette nuit sur la montagne," he replied austerely. He seemed to take his task so very seriously for one so young. He was perhaps 18. His hair was punishingly short, and he had a set expression and also the expertise of a much older servant. A gentleman's gentleman, repository of secrets, man of honour in his own right, a worthy servitor of his liege lord. "Comment vous appelez?" she asked gently. He turned at the door and smiled, revealing the chipped front tooth and the trusting eyes of a boy who had set himself stern-tasked but who was glad to be befriended. "Alain," he replied. "Je m'appelle Alain." Edith drank her coffee and reflected on the previous evening. While something had been accomplished, people were beginning to have names. The here and now, the quotidien was beginning to acquire substance, the dimension of terror that this realization brought with it, as if knowing the place too well might give her presence there some reality, some validity, was quickly palliated by the extraordinary accumulation of facts, and of such very diverting facts, that emerged from her meeting with Iris and Jennifer Pusey. Or rather, with Iris Pusey, for Jennifer was so much a reflection of her mother that although she occupied quite a large space and had a curiously insistent physical presence, she did not have too much to say for herself. And indeed, Edith had once or twice had the impression that behind her large smiling face, Jennifer was somewhere else. But at any event, Iris held the stage. Iris, it was clear, was a star. Like many a star, she could only function from a position of dominance. She held information at bay so that Edith was not required to give an account of herself. Edith, having been briefly the recipient of Mrs. Pusey's compassion, was now to become Mrs. Pusey's confidant. And what a lot there was to tell, Edith reflected. What busy lives some people led. Iris Pusey was putting in her brief annual appearance at the Hôtel du Lac for one purpose only. She had come to shop. And she was enabled to do this by virtue of the fact that her late husband had prudently deposited certain sums of money in an account in her name in a Swiss bank. Edith had learned all this by the end of the first half hour spent with Mrs. Pusey's company. Half an hour was all that was needed for the rules of the game to be set down, the wordless contract agreed upon by both parties, in return for the deliverance from that dreaded fate so systematically observed by Mrs. Pusey. Edith was to make herself available when not otherwise engaged, and that engagement would have to be submitted to fairly searching scrutiny. and to provide an audience for Mrs. Pusey's opinions, reminiscence, character readings, or general views on life's little problems. Edith acquiesced to this readily enough, not because of her plight, which she saw as irremediable, but not entirely serious, but because Mrs. Pusey presented her with the opportunity to examine and to enjoy contact with the alien species. 4. In this charming woman, so entirely estimable in her happy desire to capture hearts, so completely preoccupied with her femininity, which had always provided her with life's chief delights, Edith perceived avidity, grossness, ardour. It was her perception of this will to replenish and to triumph that occasioned her mild feelings of faintness when she watched Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer eating their dinner. She had also perceived a difference of appetite, one that seemed to carry an implicit threat to her own. Yet she dismissed this as ridiculous, dismissed it also as potentially too painful to contemplate as she sat drinking coffee in the agreeable company of Jennifer and Mrs. Pusey and basking in the high summer of their self-esteem, which in its turn shed a kindly light on all those within its orbit. And to Edith, at this strange juncture in her life, there was something soothing in this very existence of Mrs. Pusey, a woman so gentle, so greedy, so tranquil, so utterly fulfilled in her desires that she encouraged daring thoughts of possession, of accumulation in others. She was, Edith thought, an embodiment of the kind of propaganda no contemporary woman could stoop to countenance. For Mrs. Pusey was not only an enchantress in her own right, she was also appreciative of such propensities in others. She was also, by the same token, dismissive. She had unexpected areas of imagination, of generosity. For example, she saw her daughter not as a rival or as a lesser woman might have done, but as a successor to be groomed for the stardom which would eventually be hers by right. There was indeed a physical closeness between mother and daughter that surpassed anything Edith had ever known, and there was also love on both sides, although Edith registered that love as being mildly unrealistic. For in spite of Jennifer's physical stolidity, a stolidity which verged on opulence, it was clear that her mother still thought of her as a small girl. And Jennifer, probably now as a matter of habit, as well as a fondness, continued to behave like one. The result of all this was to reopen in Edith's mind the question of what behaviour most becomes a woman, the question around which she had written most of her novels, and the question which she had attempted to argue with Harold Webb, the question she had failed to answer and which she now saw to be the most vital importance, the excitement she thus experienced at being provided with an opportunity to study the question at first hand, was, if anything, heightened by the fact that everything that Mrs. Pusey had said so far was of uttermost triviality. Clearly there was depth here that deserved her prolonged attention. Mrs. Pusey had conveniently opened the debate by referring to her husband, now unfortunately dead, but still an inspiration to her, even in her thoughts. "A wonderful, wonderful man," she had said after releasing this information, the thumb and forefinger of her right hand pressed briefly above the bridge of her nose. "Don't, Mummy," begged Jennifer, her hand stroking her mother's forearm. But Mrs. Pusey gave a shaky little laugh. "She does hate me to get upset," she said to Edith. "It's all right, darling. I'm not going to be silly." And she pulled out a fine white lawn handkerchief and dabbed at the corners of her mouth. "Oh, but you can't think how I miss him," she confided to Edith. "He gave me everything I could possibly want. My early married life was like a dream. He used to say, 'Iris, if it makes you happy, buy it. I'll give you a blank check. And don't spend it all on the house. Spend it on yourself.' But of course my lovely home came first. How I adored that house. Here the thumb and forefinger once again applied to the bridge of the nose. Where do you live? Asked Edith, aware that this was an unimpressively bland question. Oh, but my dear, I'm talking about our first home in Hasselmere. Oh, I wish I had the photos here. Architect designed it was. It was my dream home, and I mustn't talk too much, because Jennifer will get upset, won't you, darling? Oh, yes, it broke my heart to leave Green Towers. I can just see it, thought Edith. Parquet floors, fitted cupboards, pictured windows, every conceivable appliance in the kitchen, gardener twice a week, gardener's wife devoted in a white overall every day, downstairs cloakroom for the gentleman to use after playing a round of golf, patio, she added. But when my husband went to head office and I saw how much travelling he was going to have to do, I put my foot down. Why should he wear himself out, I said to myself, just to please his silly little wife who loves a quiet life in the country. And anyway, I knew he'd want me to entertain for him. I knew that before he did. So we moved to St. John's Wood, Montrose Court. And of course, it's a beautiful flat, and I have an excellent housekeeper, and it's big enough for Jennifer to have her own suite. She can invite all her friends. I leave her entirely alone. And the shops are very good. She dabbed the corners of her mouth again. Of course, I have everything delivered, she added. Having assured Edith of her comfortable circumstances at home, she went on to describe to her the tenor of their life abroad. It was clear that as travelling companions, Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer were entirely compatible. Abroad was seen mainly as a repository for luxury goods. Though extensively familiar with the kind of resorts which had recently but definitely gone out of fashion. Hence their presence here, although that was also explained by the bank account and the fact that Mr. and Mrs. Pusey had known Monsieur Hubert when they had motored around and over from Montreux in the old days. But it became clear that Mr. Pusey had frequently been left at home to do whatever he did, whilst Jennifer and her mother took off for restorative trips to Cadenabia or Lucerne or Amalfi or Deauville or Menton or Bordiglia or Estoril. Once, only once, to Parma, but that was apparently a mistake. I never could stand the heat. After that, my husband said he wouldn't risk the Mediterranean again, not in high season. Of course, that was before all those package tours. Pretty place. But the heat was terrible. I spent all my time in the cathedral, trying to cool down. Never again. So Mrs. Pusey went on. She preferred the cooler weather, and they hated crowds, and Monsieur Hubert made them so welcome. Of course, they always had the same suite, the one on the third floor, overlooking the lake. Then I think we must be on the same floor and corridor, ventured Edith. My room is 307. Why, yes, said Mrs. Pusey, that little room at the end, of course. There are very few single rooms in a place like this. She looked speculatively at Edith. If we go up together, you can look in and see where we are, she said. Then, urging herself effortlessly to the edge of her chair, she attempted to rise, and after two false starts, heaved herself upright, shaking off Jennifer's arm and steadying herself on her fine ankles. This woman is getting on for 70, thought Edith. But it did not seem so, as she followed the shapely midnight blue, black back and the wake of a rosy scent into the lift and out again and along the corridor. Whilst Jennifer was allowed forward to open the door, Mrs. Pusey made herself ready to do the honours. They did indeed have a suite. There, two bedrooms could be entered separately from the corridor, but, Mrs. Pusey implied, they were invariably to be found in the small salon that connected them and with which was agreeably filled with the amenities which confident people accorded themselves in strange places. A colour television, a basket of fruit, flowers, several splits of champagne. And leading the way into her bedroom, Mrs. Pusey gestured with a smile to a negligee in oyster-coloured satin, thickly encrusted with lace, which was laid out over the back of a chair. My weakness, she confided. I do love nice things. And there's such a good shop in Montreux. That's why we come back here every year. She eyed Edith again and smiled. You should buy yourself something pretty whilst you're here, dear. A woman owes it to herself to have pretty things. And if she feels good, she looks good. That's what I tell Jennifer. I always see to it that she's fitted out like a queen. Don't I, darling? And she held out her arm to Jennifer, who walked into them and snuggled her face against her mother's. Ah, laughed Mrs. Pusey. She loves her silly mother, don't you, darling? And they embraced lovingly and walked to the door, still entwined, to see Edith out. Don't be alone, dear, said Mrs. Pusey. You know where to find us. And the door had closed. Edith found herself thinking about this conversation at various moments in the night, when the Spartan firmness of her mattress made her normally light sleep more intermittent than usual. She thought, too, of the Aladdin's cave she had perceived in the Pusey's suites, with its careless deployment of pleasurable attitudes. But most of all, she thought of the charming tableau of mother and daughter entwined, their arms locked about each other, their rosy faces turned to Edith. Seeing her, they had taken the full measure of her solitariness, and the implications of this condition showed in their expression, which had become quite innocent with surprise and pity. She had felt almost apologetic as, with a stiff little bow, and that was an association and reminiscence in itself, she had bid them good night and made her way thoughtfully to her room, and had resolved to learn and to do better, so that this particular complex of feelings might not be activated again. The next morning, dressed in her tweed skirt and her long cardigan, Edith reflected that she had perhaps been a little lax in presenting an appearance to the world, and that if the world had not shown much interest in her appearance, and what are you working on now, people asked her at parties, then it was perhaps her fault. She had failed to scale the height of consumerism and were apparently as open to her as they were to anyone else. This could now be remedied. If a woman feels good, she looks good, she said to herself, and she stepped out into the corridor. And as she crossed the foyer and went out through the revolving doors, steadying herself with a deep breath before going out into the world, she reminded herself once again of this dictum. Of course, I have everything delivered, she added. But it was clear after about 10 minutes that abroad for her, even a small resort out of season, was not the same as it was for Iris Pusey and even for Jennifer. Where they saw luxury goods, she saw only houses of detention. Pension L'Intrigue, Directeur Madame Veuve Lartigue, was followed by Clinique Les Mimosas, Doctor Privat. A small railed garden containing two men playing chess on a collapsible table, watched by 6 totally silent onlookers. Disappointed but still calm, she walked on until she came to a large cafe, its glass windows half covered with steam. She went in and sat down, taking a notebook out of her bag to give herself countenance. But the sight before her was more reassuring. A low buzz of conversation emanated from a number of sturdy-looking women, flushed waitresses carrying plates of cakes from the counter to the table. Coffee was ordered and reordered. Somewhere in the distance, Edith could hear a familiar little whine. Looking up, she saw the tall woman break off a piece of macaroon and poke it into Kiki's mouth. Catching sight of Edith, the tall woman raised her small silver fork in brief and silent greeting. Edith nodded and smiled. What on earth was this woman doing here? Mrs. Pusey, no doubt, no. And what am I doing here myself? She thought, but quelled that thought, paid her bill, and left. The rest of her walk yielded no further evidence of the symbiotic life. A small corner shop, evidently a grocery of some sort, displayed on its pavement 3 perfect, unadorned baskets of string beans. Outside the station, she bought a 3-day-old copy of the Times and returned to the hotel. She was just in time to see Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer being ceremoniously installed in the back of an old-fashioned limousine. Off to Montreux, no doubt, to get Jennifer fitted out like a queen. Edith turned slowly back into the hotel and went up in the lift, met a fresh effusion of scent in the corridor and sat down thoughtfully at the little table in her room. "My dearest David," she wrote, "well, it is all go here, a veritable whirl of activity, and an unworldly creature like myself might well have shrunk back in alarm from the sophistication of the smart set, had I not been kindly taken in hand by a respectable duana, Mrs. Iris Pusey of Montrode Court, late of Haslemere. It is thought that I might prove an acceptable companion for her daughter, Jennifer, although Jennifer is clearly destined for higher things. However, Jennifer is in no hurry to leave her mother, or so her mother assures me, and in the meantime, we are all peaceably pretending the right man will come along in due course. At the moment, there are no men at all, apart from Mrs. Pusey's husband, who seemed to have no other title or appellation, none needed, it is implied. We are on our own. She is quite the most interesting person here, although there is a beautiful woman with a dog who looks promising. Her husband is something important in Brussels, I understand. However, we have not yet spoken, and Mrs. Pusey, on the other hand, is very communicative, which is rather a blessing, because otherwise I..." This sentence she crossed out. "I adore Miss Pusey. She's totally serene, supremely confident woman who has, she laughingly suggests, simply made the best of what the good Lord gave her. She clearly has an enormous amount of money, and I'm rather interested to find out where this came from. When my husband was moved to head office, occasionally that tragic department from Haslemere, exactly did he go? What was his head office of? There is a nuance in Mrs. Pusey's behaviour, and even something, dare I say, about the cut of Jennifer's jib, that leads me to suspect that my husband might have been the kind of man who calls a shop a retail outlet. But he was clearly a man of decision. Apart from lodging some of his loot in a Swiss bank, it was he who realised he could not risk the Mediterranean in high season, could not risk it for her, I mean. Did he slip off from time to time for solitary sprees at the tables? Was he a closet member of the Marbella Club? I rather hope so, but there's no evidence to support this. Incidentally, although I have been thinking of Mrs. Pusey as a lady, I have adjusted this downward. Mrs. Pusey is definitely a woman. All woman, my husband used to call her. But he was one of those old school. And the woman with the dog has to be adjusted upwards to lady, or rather lady. She, or rather her husband, equally absent, is a member of the ruling class, although Mrs. Pusey doesn't think much of his title. Mrs. Pusey clearly dislikes Lady X. I do not know her name yet. It will be interesting to find out why. But otherwise, we all have names now. Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer, of course, and the boy who brings the breakfast is Alain, and the pretty blonde waitress at tea time is Marie-Yvonne. Edith laid down her pen. It was all very well to write up Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer, but she was still left with the memory of the two women lovingly entwined as they saw her to the door to say goodnight. For there was love there, love between mother and daughter, and physical contact and collusion about being pretty, none of which she herself had ever known. Her strange mother, Rosa, that harsh, disappointed woman, that former beauty who raged so unsuccessfully against her fate, deliberately, willfully letting herself go, slantingly and scornfully mocking her pale, silent daughter who slipped so modestly in and out of her aromatic bedroom, bringing the cups of coffee which her mother deliberately spilt and shouting, too weak, all of you, too weak, sighing for Vienna, which had known her young and brilliant and not fat and slovenly as she was now, and weeping for her dead sister Anna. Thinking of Mrs. Pusey, sparkling charm, Edith encountered painful memories. They had aged badly, the fascinating Schaffner sisters, her mother Rosa, her aunt Anna. They were enslaved, many of the students who had lodged in their mother's grim apartment whilst preparing their thesis on Klimt or Schindler or Judenstil or on all three. But although the sisters had married promptly and young, they were very soon bitterly disappointed. those students so attractive away from home, turned all too soon into mild university men. The campuses of Reading, of Nottingham, of Iowa State, of Kingston had little to offer two such accomplished Viennese flirts, with their strategies, their tactics, their mood, and their endless desire for victory. When the sisters found each other again many years later, together with their cousin Resi, it was to outbid each other with stories of horrific boredom, of husbands become too puny to interest them, of pointless days which it seemed beneath them to try to fill. Annoyance and frustration blazed from their every pore. In their mother's dark drawing room, the air was filled with dissension, with ugliness. They were now very heavy women, punishingly corseted, with very bad pencilled eyebrows and large, hard bosoms. They whipped themselves into a blaze of retrospective fury, voices raised, coffee spilling from their cups. Schrecklich, 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 they shouted. Arsch, du Schreck! 7-year-old Edith, hiding behind Grossmama, Edith's chair, heard with relief her father's key in the door and ran to him crying. The brutal sound of the words which she did not understand hurt her. Her father's guessing smiled palely and suggested that they go for a walk. He took her to the Kunsthistorisches Museum and tried to explain the pictures to her, but she pressed her wet red face against his hand and would not listen. And when he stopped longingly before a picture of men lying splayed in a cornfield under a hot sun, she burst into further tears, and he bent down and smoothed her hair back from her forehead. "Now, Edith," he had said, wiping her eyes with his handkerchief, "this is when character tells." And he had died quite young, in his early 50s. Her poor little professor, the scornful Rosa, had collapsed without him. Not a day passed, as dirtier and more irresistible, she heaped insult upon his memory. But when she, in turn, died not long after, Edith had found among her papers a faded scrap of a letter in her father's careful student German, an invitation of some kind, its purpose now lost, and only its opening sentence hinted at earlier, happier times. In a gentle, sloping hand were written the words, "Gracious lady, would you do me the honour, before the torn paper obliterated the rest of the message. Edith rubbed her eyes and picked up her pen again. "My dear darling, you cannot know how much I think of you and long for you and wait until I can see you again." This she blotted carefully and laid aside. Then, taking up the folder containing Beneath the Visiting Moon, she pulled out her papers, reread her last paragraph, and bent her head obediently to her daily task of fantasy and obfuscation.